Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to have a conversation with Dave Zirin, whose latest work is a documentary called Not Just a Game. We'll be hearing clips from that. His latest book is Bad Sports, How Owners Are Burning the Games, Ruining the Games That We Love. Of course, he's a sports writer for Nation Magazine and joins us from SiriusXM, where he is host of Edge of Sports Radio. And Dave, good to talk to you once again.
Hey, it is great to be here, Mark.
You sound almost like you're in the studio, brother.
It does have that sound, doesn't it?
Join us here, 410-319-8888. We're going to talk about the Super Bowl. We're going to talk about who owns the Green Bay Packers and why that's important. We're going to talk a little bit about Egypt. We're going to talk about how dangerous the game of football is, the militarization of our sports, and a whole lot more. So 410-319-8888 is the number here. So you've been very busy.
Oh, yeah. I've been busy. I mean, it's one thing to have the NFL about to go up in smoke with a labor lockout. It's another thing to have the Super Bowl right around the corner and have one of the teams be a publicly owned nonprofit. And then on top of it, have a series of soccer clubs leading to uprising in Egypt. Yeah, it's been kind of busy.
This before we talk about the Super Bowl, this lockout, that's going to happen when? Next season?
March 1st is the day if they don't come up with a new collective bargaining agreement. And if the players are quote-unquote locked out March 1st, it means the players aren't going to have health care, which you think about that, of all the off-season injuries that players have and the inability to actually tend to them and get medical treatment for them or paying for that out of pocket. In other words, they'll be like the rest of us. I've had a lot of discussions with players, and it's crazy, like how many of them have wives who are pregnant, little kids who need operations, and they are good and well freaking out about not having medical care come March 1st. But it also means, from a fan's perspective, everything from mini camps to free agency signings, all of that just goes kablooey this offseason if they don't have a new collective bargaining agreement.
Now, most people listening to this right now, I'm sure, would be saying themselves, wait a minute, these guys are making millions and millions of bucks a year. Why should we worry about their health care?
Yeah, why should we care about it? Well, two things I would say about that. First of all, we live in a country where organized labor has taken it on the chin for decades. Not even in the chin, in the face and all sorts of body parts for decades. And there was a time in this country, Mark, when every newspaper had a reporter who was on the labor beat. And the labor beat was a part of newspaper coverage.
That's right.
Today, the only time you really hear about labor conflicts is when it happens in sports. So I would argue it has quite the ripple effect culturally when you have a group of players, many of whom come from poor and working class backgrounds, going up against 31 of the most powerful billionaires in the country in a labor conflict. That really means something. And when you couple on top of that the fact that a typical player only plays 3.5 years and that a typical player always retires with the kinds of injuries that nag them for the rest of their lives, I mean, you're dealing with a lot of issues here about right and wrong, fairness and unfairness. And when you couple on top of that, Mark, that football is the most popular sport in the country, and if there's a work stoppage, it will be a lockout. The players want to play. They're saying, let's just play under the existing contract. And the fact that owners will just lock the doors. And then when you put on top of that, that if the players are locked out, it also means all the concession workers are going to be locked out, all the stadium workers are going to be locked out, all the waiters and waitresses getting extra shifts at the restaurants near the stadium get locked out. Then I would say this actually matters to a lot more Americans than just the ones who put shoulder pads on Sundays.
So if this ends, if this starts March the 1st, does it carry on into the season?
It could. That's the question. I mean, you have to understand, Damora Smith, who heads the union, and Roger Goodell, who heads up the owners, they've had two meetings in the last 6 months, two face-to-faces. The bad blood is very real, and one of the reasons for it is that Goodell's proposal is, we want the season to go to 18 games and we want to pay you 20% less. What do you say? That's a tough thing, given the popularity and growth of the sport, for the union to be able to stomach, especially when the number of seasons you play as a player reflects how many medical benefits you get and pension when it's all said and done. So when the season's two games longer and any play can be your last, well, you can do the math.
And, you know, I just read the article in the New York Magazine, which is really good. It's going to be on our website because I think that it's an eye-opening article by Ben McGrath. Does football have a future? Have you seen it?
Yes, I have.
Okay. About the dangerous nature of football. As a matter of fact, we have a question which just came in from Mike Berla, one of our listeners, who wrote in at steinershow@gmail.com. By the way, you can also call in at 410-319-8888. And Mike wrote in, given the growing evidence of the dangerous nature of football, and not just at the pro level, at every level, in the future, how many parents are going to sign off on letting their kids play and thereby multiply the risk of early dementia? Will football, like boxing before it, become solely perceived as an escape route for the underclass?
I think that is an incredibly fair question and a very real question. And you know what? It's become the default question that I now ask NFL players when I interview them is, do you want your kids playing this game? And the overwhelming majority of them, sometimes off the record, but the overwhelming majority say some form of, well, actually, I'm playing so my kids don't have to. I mean, it's that brutal, and the evidence of early onset dementia is so powerful that I really do think that the future of football is going to be akin to boxing. In other words, you're not going to see football banned in this country as if it's cockfighting or dogfighting or anything like that. But you've noticed with boxing, I mean, it's been more like an accordion that you squeeze closed and the music slowly drifts out of it.
Yeah.
To the point now where boxing used to be the most popular sport in the United States, and now, you know, one could probably, a typical sports fan could probably name only three or four boxers. I think football is going to experience a similar slow decline in popularity unless they can come up with ways to tweak the rules or tweak the uniforms to make it safer. But every single scientific expert says that that's an impossibility. It's like asking a cat to bark. I mean, to say that we're going to make football safe, it just is not something possible.
Yeah, that's it's. I was reading the article and I was watching your documentary again last night. I really was wrestling with this. I mean, you played sports in high school.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep. Sure did.
I did all the way through high school. I played soccer. I boxed, you know, and I even got into. I was a terrible football player. All I could do was play defensive half because I couldn't catch the ball. But.
But you were like Roberto Duran, hands of stone.
Hands of stone, man. I could knock it down, but I couldn't catch it. But the issue is, that it's something that's almost in the male psyche and blood to play these games.
Well,
whether it's
interesting.
You know, I mean, whether we're conditioned to do it or whatever that is, it is in us, and we do it. And it's a very tough issue to wrestle with because people want to play it, but increasingly we're seeing how dangerous football is to the survival of its long-term players.
See, it's interesting because I really believe that sports are more a reflection of our society in the present tense than of something that exists for time immemorial. I mean, because one of the things that we know, Mark, and anthropologists have shown this, is that as soon as human beings have been able to clothe and feed themselves, they've played games.
Right.
That means sports is very much a part of our basic humanity. And football, a sport that bruises the brain, a sport that causes early onset dementia, is very much a sport of the 20th century. I mean, it's a sport that was popularized by Teddy Roosevelt as a way to toughen up young men at Ivy League elite schools for the new American century,
right,
and making them fit to rule. So it's very much tied into the American mystique. And before we think it's too much a part of an intrinsic part of the male psyche, let's remember that this is the only part of the world that plays football. And other parts of the world take it as really a point of pride that they don't play American football. Ask someone in another country, they say, no, we don't play football. We already play football. You just call it soccer. Or I have a good buddy from Puerto Rico who always says, hey, we like real football in Puerto Rico, not football imperialismo, which is what you guys play. So it's very much bound with America and Americana. And just to be clear, so no one thinks I'm on a high horse, I still find myself to be a fan. I mean, it's very hard sometimes to separate yourself from the culture, especially in these towns, in the Baltimore, D.C. area.
Yeah,
it's hard
yes.
not to get sucked in and get into it. I just think there's something dangerous about us accepting it as if there are no human consequences off the field.
So how do you address that? And folks, you join us here at 410-319-8888. I know most of the people out there listening will be glued to the sets on Sunday to watch the Super Bowl.
And I say something else, Mark?
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
Well, just that you made reference to the film, not just a game. I'd be remiss
right.
if I didn't tell your audience that we're going to do a showing of it in Baltimore.
Oh, I'm going to tell them.
On March 29th. And I'm just very excited about it.
No, it's very cool. I'm glad you're coming.
A benefit for Workers United and the Algebra Project, two terrific organizations. And it's going to be at the 2640 space in Baltimore.
And it's the United Workers that actually clean the stadiums themselves.
Exactly.
That's how they started organizing as a union, as a the workers who parked the cars and cleaned the stalls and cleaned the bathrooms.
And but supposedly pro-labor Peter Angelos.
Exactly. Underpaid.
Yeah.
I did a whole series of those guys, and those United workers who clean the stadiums here, a lot of them were homeless or had to double and triple up in homes just to survive. And I interviewed one family where the mother had to live with an aunt and two of the girls, and the father had to live with two of the boys at his grandfather's house because they couldn't, with two salaries, afford one home.
You know, it's really remarkable because it also, especially in a city like Baltimore, you get two visions of if you grow up poor and African American in the United States, there's you can grow up to become Ray Lewis or Ed Reed and make a lot of money but put your body through an unbelievable amount of punishment for the privilege of making that money, or you could clean up after the people who cheer for Ray Lewis and Ed Reed.
Right, exactly. Folks, join us here, 410-319-8888. We'll all be glued to the set. Many of us will. I will be, to watch the Super Bowl game, and I know which side I'll be cheering for. And that'll be Green Bay.
Yep, you know it.
And not just because the Steelers beat us, just because I like Green Bay for the reason we'll talk about in a while, because it's a people's team. But you watch this game, you love the game, but you know the danger of it at the same time and mm-hmm. what happens to the men in it. And that's kind of the contradiction you were talking about before. I mean, you know, we as much as we know, we're still there.
Yeah. No, that's true. And, you know, it's like I love certain kinds of music while understanding the exploitation that goes into creating that music. I love architecture, knowing the blood, sweat, and tears that create that architecture. I do love football while trying to be very mindful of the fact that if we lived in a more sane society, and I do believe that sports reflect our society, that football probably would not be a sport of choice.
Let me give people a little flavor of your film. I'm going to talk about this film in terms of especially the football game, the Super Bowl coming up, and the nature of football in society. Let's run the intro to the movie here real fast.
I'm Dave Zirin, and I love sports. I grew up idolizing guys like Lawrence Taylor, Gary Carter, and Magic Johnson. And like most young boys in this country, one message was fed to me every time I took the field or watched a game. And it's a message that's only grown stronger with time. What Howard Cosell called rule number one of the jockocracy. The idea that sports and politics just don't mix.
They don't mix, but they have always mixed. It just depends mm-hmm. which side you're looking at it from.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they say sports and politics don't mix. That message is certainly hammered home to athletes when they try to say political things. But what we try to argue in the film is that politics are always in sports, but what's normalized is a specific kind of politics, a politics that feasts on things like machismo, hyper-patriotism, nationalism, militarism. This is something always present in sports, and it's when athletes actually transgress against that, say speaking out against war or something of the like, that they're really isolated and treated as if they're somehow oddballs. And one of the reasons is that not because they're bringing politics into a no-politics zone, but they're bringing counter-politics to mm-hmm. an already hyper-politicized realm.
And you point that out in the movie a lot with the
in
terms of the ties that football has always had to the military. You wrote on your Facebook page today about honoring Ronald Reagan at halftime.
That's part of this year's broadcast. They're honoring the 100th anniversary of Ronald Reagan.
Not that we shouldn't honor any president, but in his 100th anniversary. But the politics have always been there, as have the politics of really the conservative politics of America has really have dominated our sports.
Yeah, and that's because – and this isn't an accident. I mean, it's because conservative politics have dominated the owner's box. And that's another thing that makes this year's Super Bowl really so remarkable because, look, I'm no Steelers fan by any stretch of the imagination. I'm one of those people who says my two favorite teams are the Ravens and whoever plays the Steelers. But the Steelers' ownership in the guise of the Rooneys are actually – they're liberal money people. I mean, they're Democratic Party big money people. And, you know, that might not exactly thrill anybody out there, any big money, big political people in terms of your audience. But I will say that that's in stark contrast to many pro sports owners who are actually the people who bankroll lobbyists for Blackwater. And I talk about this in great deal in the book, lobbyists for Focus on the Family, organizations in Colorado Springs that promote things like gay reparative therapy. I mean, the whole carnival of the right-wing fringe of this country has a money train into the owners' boxes in professional sports. And what's particularly disturbing about that, of course, is the public subsidies that go into pro stadiums, which means that you get what amounts to political money laundering. The money goes into the stadium out of our pockets, and then it goes into the owners' pockets, and then it goes into a lot of organizations that I think a lot of fans would find rather repellent.
You know, and it's interesting to watch the politics of sports in America and in the film. And I know a lot of people who listen to this program are involved in sports. A lot of women are involved in sports. A lot of our daughters are involved in sports. And it's become huge in America. But let me play this clip. This is clip number four. I want to play clip number four, and we set that up. And this is about I think this is a piece about a New York Times columnist speaking about women in the Olympics. But listen to this.
In 1953, Pulitzer Prize-winning sports columnist Arthur Daly of the New York Times said that eliminating women from the Olympics was, quote, a great idea, writing that there's nothing feminine or enchanting about a girl with beads of perspiration in her alabaster brow, the result of grotesque contortions in events totally unsuited to female architecture, adding that any self-respecting schoolboy can achieve superior performances to a woman champion.
Yikes. And that was one of the tamer things.
That's one of the tamer things.
Because it's one of the arguments in that section of the film is that for women in sports, it's never been a question of being granted the right to play. It's always been something and space that's always had to be fought for. It's always been contested space.
But even the nomenclature we use, I mean, we talk about, you have that one scene in the film where football player's admonishing his fellow teammates not to play like girls, don't play, you know, and to take off that skirt and stand like a man. You know, I mean, that's it's the way we think about it as well.
Oh, yeah. And that's very interesting because that also ties into war, too, because it's this idea of being masculine, and this is connected with the idea of being someone who plays sports, and sports is also often akin to war. And so those are the two big metaphors that you use. Don't be a woman. Don't be feminine. Don't be soft. Be like a soldier. Fight, fight, fight. And so what we get, though, of course, is not a morality play about the actuality of war with all its horror and death. What you get is kind of a puff piece version of war, like war as created by, I don't know, by Michael Bay or Jerry Bruckheimer, like a fake staged version of war. It's a lot of male sports and women are there to cheer for the boys, basically. And that's also something, by the way, very unique to American sports, the idea that women are there to cheer for the boys. And we talk about this in the film because if we're sold a false vision of what it means to be a real man through sports, then maybe we're also sold a false vision of what it means to go to war through sports. And maybe that blinds us to the actualities and the true costs of war, which makes things like the last decade that we've all endured and are still enduring all the more possible.
And nothing more emblematic of that than that part of your film when you talked about Pat Tillman,
because the thing about Pat Tillman, of course, the former Arizona Cardinal turned Army Ranger turned casualty of war, and I'm sure your listeners know at this point, but the conditions of his death were a complete fabrication, died at the hands of friendly fire of his own troops under very bizarre and suspicious circumstances. His family was told that he died in battle, heroically charging a hill and all the rest of it, and with a nationally televised funeral that was on ESPN. I mean, one of the things about Pat Tillman is this idea of him being a real man because he went from football to the Army Rangers is something still celebrated by both the armed forces and the NFL. I mean, the NFL opened the Pat Tillman USO Center in Afghanistan. And yet at the same time, one of the things that they never talk about in the NFL is the fact that Pat Tillman's family has been fighting for justice to find out what really happened to Pat, and that Pat Tillman had long ago turned against the war in Iraq, calling it illegal to anybody who would listen, while he was an Army Ranger. And so you see that the NFL is obviously much more comfortable with a vision of men who fight wars as opposed to men who oppose them. When I would argue that opposing a war as an Army Ranger takes a hell of a lot of courage.
As it did for someone like Muhammad Ali to do it.
Exactly.
That you talk
and
about.
And I think why Ali still sort of bewitches so many of us is that he's somebody who couldn't really be dismissed with that paradigm about being feminine or being somehow unmanly. I mean, he was the heavyweight boxing champion of the world. It's pretty hard to dismiss someone like that with homophobic or sexist caricatures. And at the same time, Muhammad Ali was never shy about telling people how pretty he was, and which was another thing which I think sent people into sort of twisted fits, because the heavyweight champion isn't supposed to be pretty. They're supposed to look like Rocky Marciano and be just plug butt ugly. And then at the same time with Ali, that he had this poetry about the way he would speak and this firmness of principle. And it was the sort of thing that people couldn't really even wrap their hands around. Like, he made the idea of dissenting against the war cool and fearless. And he made it about real courage. It takes real courage to oppose war. And he did that really in a lot of ways through the force of his will and, of course, with the benefit of a mass movement against the war at the same time. And you got to talk about Ali. And I was just recently speaking. I did a show with Michael Eric Dyson, the great writer
sure.
and professor.
Yep.
And
the show is on the station, emanates from the station.
Oh, wow. And Dr. Dyson made this point where he said, shame on this country that will embrace a Muhammad Ali only when he's lost the power of speech.
Right. Which is what we've done.
Yes.
When he can be almost sanitized. From mm-hmm. what he was, because he can't. It's true.
Like a postage stamp.
Right. 410-319-8888. Join us here. Dave Zirin is with us. Sports writer for The Nation magazine. His latest documentary is Not Just a Game. He's the host of Edge of Sports Radio on Sirius XM. And his latest book is Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love. And we talked to him about that book not long ago. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. We can talk a bit of Super Bowl, talk a bit about what this game means. The lockout could be coming up behind it. Your thoughts on that. And, you know, the other thing is that I got to ask you this question. I've been wanting to ask you, look at your writing, and I look at your Facebook page and see the stuff that pops up there. Interesting discussions.
Oh, yeah.
but now, this and a lot of folks here at the station, this WEA here, are Washington fans.
Mm-hmm.
You're a Washington fan.
For better or worse.
All right. So, but even though you write about it, you've written about it, even you... When you refer to the team, use the word I won't use. Like, I have this big fight mm-hmm. with my dear friend and operations manager and engineer at the station, the R word,
mm-hmm.
because it is such a racist term.
Mm-hmm. It is a disgusting term, and I have taken great pains to write repeatedly and numerous articles about the origins of the word, because, and I won't say it out of respect for you, the main reason that I say it in part, first of all, usually when I write about it, it's because I'm writing about the history of it.
And
then I feel like it's like you have to because like this is what's so offensive and so terrible. But I try to say I try to do what Doc Walker does, the former great player for that particular team. And when he refers to the team, you notice he always says the burgundy and gold.
Exactly.
And he's a big sports radio guy. He's always just saying the burgundy and gold. And it's because a lot of players hate it as well. I mean, it's disgusting and it's an anachronism. But even worse than that, there's a history about where it's rooted, which is such an offense and a slap in the face, not just to Native people, but to African-American people. And, of course, D.C. is a majority African-American city. I mean, the team is called the R word because I feel like I should say it because we're talking about it.
Go ahead.
It's called the Redskins because the team was founded by a segregationist named George Preston Marshall. And so he was selling minstrelsy to the South. When they came to Washington, they were the southernmost team in the NFL. And so this was about selling minstrelsy. I mean, the team would sing Dixie before every home game. he would make his and when they finally integrated in 1961, it's the 50th anniversary, and they did it because, first of all, the Kennedy administration, there were demonstrations of groups like the NAACP and CORE, and there were also demonstrations, I'm writing an article about this, I've been researching it, by the American Nazi Party, like in front of the old Griffith Stadium, to say, no, keep the team all white. I mean, it was a crazy situation. And when he finally got black players on the team, and he did because not only the demonstrations, but because the Kennedy administration was like, hey, your new stadium's on federal land. If you want to keep it, you might want to get some black players here. And so he would even make his African-American players take part in singing Dixie before the home games. And in even the song that people know so well, like the Redskins fight song, which ends, fight for old D.C., George Preston Marshall had made sure the original lyrics were fight for old Dixie. So it's so rooted in Confederate politics that it should be rejected the same way we would reject if the mayor of D.C., Vincent Gray, said he wanted to fly the Confederate flag from his car. Obviously, people would be up in arms over right. that. And people should be up in arms that we have a team that's named after a racial slur.
Dave Zirin is with us. A man who takes sports to new heights with his work. He's a sports writer for Nation Magazine, host of Edge of Sports Radio on Sirius XM, where he joins us from right now. His latest documentary, Not Just a Game, his latest book, Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love. And you can join us here. We'll be right back. We'll take a short break and come back with Dave Zirin. Remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner here with Dave Zirin, sports writer for Nation Magazine, host of Edge of Sports Radio, Sirius XM, where he joins us from at this moment. And we'll talk more about his documentary, Not Just a Game. He'll be here March 29th, which we'll tell you more about that. We get close to that date in a benefit to show his, we'll be showing his documentary, benefit for the Ottawa Project and the United Workers over at 2640 Space, which is, of course, down on Calvert Street. 410-319-8888 is the number here. You were on Tell Me More this morning.
Yes.
Yes. So...
Yes, I was.
Yes, you were. I love Michelle. She's great. So help us here. Let's make this comparison you were doing a little while ago. There. Compare Roger Goodell to Hosni Mubarak.
Oh, I didn't really do that on
No, but you were joking about it on your website.
I also said that Roger Goodell was going to figure out a way to fine several of the Steelers for for Egyptian rioting or something, but for beating up Anderson Cooper or something, because he's always finding.
But all seriousness, just to talk, it's an interesting comparison, though.
Well, only to the degree to which I think Roger Goodell is incredibly, incredibly out of touch, and players do not like him at all. And the reason they don't like him is not because he wants to get a bigger piece of the pie for the owners. That's his job. What they don't like about him is all of the feigned sincerity about concussions and the welfare of the players, and then saying, oh, by the way, we want you to play two more games a year. How does that sound? And I have not met one player, and frankly, I haven't met one fan who wants a longer season.
Yeah.
See, I think that the NFL is the only sport that gets it right in terms of the length of their season. I interviewed 3,000 fans for Bad Sports, and one of the things that I heard more than anything else was that the seasons in most sports are just too long. And you just can't. It's exhausting to be a baseball fan. It's exhausting to be an NBA or NHL fan.
Oh my God!
You just tune in partway through. Football gets it with 16 games right. over 17 weeks. It keeps your attention. And the idea that he wants to extend it while saying he cares about the welfare of the players is ridiculous. They also think he's a hypocrite for giving these huge mammoth fines for these big jacked up hits that occur in the games. And then they celebrate those hits on the NFL Network.
Over
they celebrate
and over.
Them in their video games, you know, where we can program the guys to really jack up another player. And they just like, this is absolute garbage. And then the other thing is, and this is every player knows what I'm about to say, is that the concussions really don't happen with those huge mammoth hits that get the big fines. They happen during practice, during the week. I mean, they happen in all kinds of small ways that you never even notice as a fan, and that Goodell has given no indication he intends to curb.
Let's open the phones here before I take us to Egypt for a moment. 410, let Dave take us to Egypt. 410-319-8888. Ken in Capitol Heights, you're on the air.
Yes, how are you this evening?
I'm well, welcome.
Hey, listen, and hello to your guest as well.
Hello, sir.
Hey, listen, I'm a Boston boy, and about the Boston Red Sox, some fans claim that they had a drought up there, a 25 or 30-year drought or something like that. And I think, did Willie Mays try out for that team at one time and they turned him down?
Yes.
Okay, and from what I understand, Ted Williams wanted him to play.
That is true.
And because Ted Williams, being the perfectionist that he was, and I'm just saying that, could you imagine to have Mays and Williams in the outfield?
I mean, I've always said that. I mean, the Red Sox, of course, went over like 90 years in between World Series titles.
Right.
And they called it the curse of the Bambino because they traded Babe Ruth.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote at the time, it's not the curse of the Bambino, it's the curse of the racist ownership. Because if you had Ted Williams and Willie Mays in the same outfield, if you hadn't been the last team to desegregate, right, you would have done just fine. You would have done very well, in fact. And I'll tell you something about Ted Williams that a lot of people do not know. Ted Williams is the answer to the trivia question, who is the best Latino baseball player to ever play Major League Baseball? His mother was Mexican, and he grew up having to he could pass. He was very light-skinned,
mm-hmm,
but his family suffered a great deal of racism growing up, which is another reason why he was very sympathetic to getting Willie Mays on the team.
Yeah, I guess a lot of people don't know that fact. I just wanted to, you to verify that.
All right.
Ken, sir.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
I appreciate your calling. Thanks so much.
All righty.
That's interesting. I think that's probably one of the best-kept secrets in baseball.
Yeah, Latino Ted Williams is one of the best-kept secrets in baseball, yes.
It truly is. You had on your SportsIllustrated.com, SI.com, you have the – you wrote about soccer clubs being central to ending Egypt's dictatorship. That's an interesting piece. Tell our listeners about that who might not have seen it online. We'll link it, but talk about it.
Oh, this is both wild and wildly unreported. I mean, the soccer clubs in Egypt have always been a center of anger and dissent and a place where the most disenfranchised in society, disenfranchised young men to be specific, would gather to vent, scream, and let off steam. And there's a tradition in Egypt of it being an organizing, unlike many countries, of it being a political organizing center as well. The most popular team, really the sort of the New York Yankees of Egypt, is a team called Alawi, the Alawi, and I apologize for my pronunciation, but the Alawi Pharaohs. And they started in 1907. Alawi in Arabic means the national, because they were going to be a team that promoted a national ideal of Egyptian consciousness in the face of British colonialism, because it was under the thumb of British colonial rule at the time. I mean, that's the roots of that franchise. And they have these hyper fan clubs called the Ultras, which migrated over from Italy, this idea of you have super fan clubs, the Ultras. And there are reports from the very beginning that the Ultras were in the streets of Egypt. They were some of the first people setting up the neighborhood checkpoints, some of the first people organizing the neighborhood committees, trying to keep the neighborhood safe before Mubarak, as today, made Egypt profoundly unsafe. And they played a role as well in just fighting off the security forces, because that's been one of the few places in the 30-year dictatorship of Mubarak that you had a consistent amount of street fighting and conflict with the hated secret police, was the soccer clubs after soccer matches. Now, it wasn't very political when those would happen, at least ostensibly, but clearly it was for the people involved, because they really have sprung into action in Egypt.
I knew nothing about that to your column, about the political nature of the soccer clubs and leading the way and refusing to play. They stopped playing, they boycott the games.
It's interesting, yeah, because the media in this country has ignored that part of the story, and obviously the sports, ESPN isn't exactly doing a story on the soccer clubs. But I'll tell you who actually appreciates what the soccer clubs have done. Particularly, I want to say this, if anybody out there thinks I'm puffing it up a little bit or giving it more credit than it's worth, is Egypt on Thursday canceled all the soccer matches because they were worried about the clubs getting together. And that was too little too late, of course. Then Libya canceled all its soccer matches because Libya shares a border with Egypt. And they were worried about the soccer clubs in Libya starting to explode and being a challenge to Gaddafi. And they're trying to head off the contagion of rebellion from getting into Libya. So the autocrats and dictators of North Africa and the Middle East very much understand the catalytic role that soccer could play.
Okay. We've been watching this a great deal and covering it a great deal this week, what's going on in Egypt. We're not doing it today, but we've been doing it. It's just amazing to watch this thing unfold. It's just unbelievable. We've had Fawaz Gerges and Talbot Abdullah, Nancy Youssef and others. It's been amazing to watch. It's like when you can watch it in real time in Al Jazeera, it's like watching this revolution before your eyes.
It really is. And the descriptions, I mean, really remind you of those other revolutionary great dates in history from 1989 to 1968, 1917. I mean, you read the actual descriptions of what was happening on the ground in those dates about people really springing to life from docility. And that's what you're seeing in Egypt. And I think for people in America, it's worth saying that one of the things you always hear about America is that it's apathetic and people care too much about consumer culture and no one will ever get up and do anything. I have Egyptian friends who have said to me, this is what we've been saying for years in Egypt.
Right.
It's apathetic. People are docile. No one cares. I mean, and this is why the soccer clubs have proven so critical, because there really hasn't been political space for people in Egypt. There is no thriving political culture. It's not San Francisco in 1967. I mean, it's Egypt. And so it just shows you, like, the thirst for politics was so intense. It sluiced out in all kinds of ways, whether through the mosque, through the soccer clubs, or just in the streets.
And I guess it is true, then, I guess, that the revolution will be televised.
And isn't that amazing, too? Very, very well said. But how amazing is it that the Egyptian protesters, so conscious about the importance of media, like really walking up to the state media station as one of the first acts? Really amazing.
Let's go back to the phones. Pardon me. 410-319-8888. Dean on the east side, you're on the air.
Hello? Am I on?
You're on, Dean.
Yes. Okay, yeah. I just want to say that your guest, I've listened to him on another station, and I always wanted to say that I think it's disingenuous for us to think that the owners of sports teams to monitor and to stop the players from taking steroids, because I mean athletes are basically entertainers. I mean I would like to compare it to this. You know, men who go to the strip clubs don't have a problem, with strippers using implants. I mean, you're just there. You know, they're entertainers. So, for us to think that, NFL owners, going to crack down on steroids use, and it's just going to be impossible. I think that Congress need to be much more forceful in implementing these rules, because so far people who have taken steroids, nothing has happened to them.
Yeah, I'm glad you called in and said that. I mean, I've long been a critic of the idea that this would be something that owners oversee, largely because they have a vested interest in making sure that the game is as unsafe and its players are as muscular as possible. I mean, one of the things that we know about steroids, and there's so much misinformation out there, but one of the things we know is a stone-cold fact, is that steroids are dangerous not when they're used, but when they're abused. And when they are taken under the auspices and care of medical professionals, they are not, in fact, dangerous. Unfortunately, in the world of sports, they are usually taken in bathroom stalls and back alleys and gyms by people who are trainers and utterly unqualified to do so. And I think owners have been guilty of, if not benign neglect, then malignant intent when it comes to steroids and sports. I mean, what I think we would all like to see is a standard that makes sense, that takes into account the health of players, their long-term health interests, so there's not a peer pressure on players who don't want to take steroids to take them, while at the same time dispensing with the hypocrisy that says it's okay to shoot your knees up full of Novocaine and go back out on the field, but it's not okay to take something that would actually perhaps help you heal faster.
Well, you know, I mean, a couple of things came to my mind as you were saying that. I mean, we clearly made steroids into an illicit drug for athletes and made that an illicit market. And we've also, you know, as long as our sports are driven by solely by the profit of the owners to make money on us and their athletes, this is just going to keep occurring. I mean, anything to make the profit larger is what they'll do.
I'll tell you something else which also drives it is the skill difference between a player who plays in the minor league or triple A level in baseball, for example, or in the D League in the NBA, and people who play at the major league level. The skill level is razor thin, and yet the monetary difference is beyond vast. I mean, you're talking about the difference in minor league to major league baseball. The difference between making as much as a top doctor versus making as much as somebody who works a cash register part-time at a fast food place.
Right.
I mean, this is the difference. And so you think about that, and you think about the socioeconomic background of many athletes, and you think about the temptation. And it's real, and it's not going to be solved by owners who have a vested interest, like I said, in seeing the sport as unsafe as possible.
You have you had an interesting article on your Facebook page that I read earlier today about the public ownership of the Green Bay Packers. That was really an intense article.
It was really good by Patrick Ruby.
Patrick Ruby. Who is Patrick Ruby? I've never read him before.
Yeah, I mean, Patrick Ruby is a freelance writer. He writes for ESPN as a freelancer on their Page 2 section, and he's quite good. I mean, he co-hosts my radio show with me sometimes, and I think he's a very, very talented writer. You go to his website, Patrick Ruby, and it's H-R-U-B-Y .net, and you see just a wide array of subjects that he takes on. And his take on Green Bay, what was really interesting and really intense, and one of the points that Patrick makes is we wouldn't be having this discussion about a lockout if all teams were run in this way, if teams had fans who own shares in them instead of teams that had owners who were out for the buck. We wouldn't be dealing with this. We certainly, in places like Minnesota, wouldn't be dealing with an owner saying, give me more public subsidies in these tight economic times, build me a stadium, or I'm going to move the team to Los Angeles. We wouldn't have had the Baltimore Colts become the Indianapolis Colts,
right,
to be very blunt
about
it.
The Cleveland Browns become the Baltimore Ravens.
Yes, exactly. And then having no Cleveland Browns becoming this horrifying genetic mutation that is currently called the Cleveland Browns. I mean, I was in Cleveland, and people there are still like, you have the Cleveland Browns in Baltimore. Your terrific 12-4 team, that should be our team. And I'm just like, look, you have the Cleveland Browns. Just don't worry. And they're like, no. These guys are so awful. They can't be the Cleveland Browns. Don't say that.
But what is it? What does it mean for the Green Bay Packers to be a nonprofit team? And tell the story a bit for people.
Oh my
who don't
gosh!
Know.
Well, yeah. I mean, what it means is that the team is, first of all, it's a source of economic stability as opposed to something that's a drain on the local treasury. The Green Bay Packers have been a publicly owned team since 1923. And they became that way because the team was about to go under. And 1923 is an NFL that you would not recognize. I mean, it was a league where you could win a team in a card game. The New York Giants were actually won in a card game. Or you could be somebody like Art Rooney of the Steelers who could make a ton of money on the racetrack and then get a team. You know, I mean, it was a bare bones league. It was considered very low culture at the time. And the Packers just wanted to keep their team. And so they said, okay, let's make it a fan-owned entity. And that's the way it was. And then in 1960, when Pete Rozelle, commissioner of the NFL, realized the potential of the league, which was only just beginning to be realized that television would change the way people saw football, that it was just a brilliant game for a television set, that he had it written into the NFL's constitution, the vaunted NFL bylaws, that no other team could be run as a nonprofit, which the Packers were, are, and will always be. And so that is written in that constitution to make sure no other team follows that lead. Yeah, the Packers have not one owner, they have 112,000 owners, and no one is permitted to own more than a set share of the team. No one pulls a dividend profit. All you get is a little piece of paper that says you're part owner of the Packers. 60% of all concessions go to local charities, to the economy. Even beer at a Packers game costs $5. And if you know
that's
how much
when,
beer
when I read
costs.
That, I was blown away by that. Five. I mean, you have to like take out a second mortgage to buy beer at a game.
Exactly. Tickets are also slightly lower. And you know, when there are snowstorms in Green Bay, people have volunteered to shovel. And part of that is out of community pride, but part of that is also because they understand that when the team plays, the whole community does well. But imagine, like, if Dan Snyder put out the call for people in D.C. to shovel. I mean, people would be like, people would tell him to use his head as a rectal thermometer, for goodness sakes. So you see the role that Green Bay plays. And honestly, I also find it very compelling that Green Bay is one of those places that should be part of the so-called Rust Belt. You know, a place that used to be an industrial hub that, you know, the industry has gone away. I mean, our sports teams could be places that keep our industrial hubs at least afloat in places like Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Oakland, Buffalo. But instead, they're drains.
It's something that I don't think we think about very much, or the public thinks about very much, because it's just not part of our discourse. The idea that someone should actually be able to challenge that ruling, some municipalities like Baltimore to be able to say we want the Ravens to be owned by our community. We want them here.
Yeah, and it's so ridiculous, this argument that people sometimes throw back at me saying, well, but it's written into the NFL's constitution, as if that's the Ten Commandments or something, as if that was somehow a decree of Congress or a holy writ. It's the NFL constitution. It can be challenged legally like any other sort of private document written for the purposes of a monopoly. And you know what else about it, too? It's also so reveals what Art Modell, of course, the former owner of the Ravens, he once called NFL owners, he said, a group of capitalists who act like socialists. And it's a great example of that because, first of all, they revenue share to make sure every team has a chance. And second of all, they collude and they're actually anti-competition because if they were really for competition, fans should be able to buy the teams and be able to run them in a way that benefit the community. I think we would all be better off. The only people who wouldn't be better off would be the 31 families that own the other teams. And I'll tell you what, let's put the over-under at 0.5 about whether or not the fact that the Green Bay Packers are a nonprofit, fan-owned team even gets mentioned during the Super Bowl broadcast. When they'll talk about everything from what Aaron Rodgers ate that morning for breakfast to what Ben Roethlisberger has stuck between his toes. They'll talk about everything during that broadcast, but they won't talk about the most important issue of all.
And then is that why you're a Green Bay fan on Sunday?
Well, honestly, I'm a Green Bay fan because I am a Ravens fan, and I find the Steelers to be somewhat repellent on numerous levels. And I can't help it. I mean, I went to the Saints-Ravens game at the stadium there.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought it was hilarious, like, at a Saints-Ravens game, how many anti-Steeler T-shirts I saw. I was like, they're not even here. Why are you wearing an anti-Steelers shirt? But I feel that very much. And I'm also rooting for the Packers because I think it would be a very, very delicious moment when they have to do that ceremony of giving the Lombardi trophy to the owner of the team. And they have to give it to Bob Harlan, who's the head of the board of directors of the public trust that is the Green Bay Packers.
That would be very sweet. I would love to see that happen. I mean, the Steelers are on a roll, but I just would love to see them stopped.
Yeah, I mean, people who do this for a living say that it would be a bit foolish to bet against the Steelers, also because they have a lot of players who've played in Super Bowls. I mean, on the Steelers' side. But Green Bay is hot also, and in Aaron Rodgers, they have a quarterback who sometimes doubles as Superman, so you never know.
One of the things that struck me watching this games recently is how the makeup of football teams are changing. I mean, in terms of more and more, it seems like more there's more diversity among the ethnic origins of the players.
Oh, well, that's certainly true. I mean, and some of that is just about the popularity of the NFL, which means more kids play it. And that's why it's going to be very interesting if the next generation of kids are kept away from it because of fears of concussions and other risks like that. I mean, think about a player like Clay Matthews Jr., who's the incredible star of the Green Bay Packers, who's a third-generation NFL player. What if Clay Matthews Jr., whatever his son's name is actually kept out of playing because of that. But no, it's definitely true that the NFL at this point is just is It really is remarkably diverse. I mean, especially when you consider just the Samoa and the Samoan Islands.
Yes.
And the incredible percentage of players who actually come out of that very small space.
It's they said the same thing about soccer. I can remember when I played soccer for many years. And all of a sudden this report came out about soccer balls causing concussions. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's real. I mean, I think people think of the word concussion and think of some sort of seismic accident.
Right.
But a concussion, at its most basic definition, is a bruise on your brain. That's all it is. And think about how little it takes to get a bruise on your leg or on your arm. That's what you're talking about when you're talking about concussion. And ironically, the better the helmets have gotten in the NFL, the worse the concussion risk. Because, one, you can play longer without perhaps realizing you're hurt. And, two, it's the jostling of the brain inside a helmet that oftentimes players are leading with to tackle because they feel like they're impervious because of the helmet.
Dave Zirin, it's always a pleasure to have you on the air with us. Thank you so much, man.
My privilege, Mark, and I hope everybody comes out on the 29th to see the film.
We will we will promote it even closer to the date. Make sure they're out there to see that.
Thank you so much, Mark.
And on your end, thank Mike Hart for engineering at SiriusXM.
You got it.
Thank you. Thank you. We're here with Dave Zirin, of course, sports writer for Nation Magazine. Not Just a Game is the name of his new documentary. And listen to him on Edge of Sports on SiriusXM. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community to prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com, or go to thesteinershow.org and click on their banner. All the information is there, too. We'll be right back. We've had Dr. Chris Marsh on a lot, talking about black families. There's always been a lot of pushback on what she said, and one of those people who pushed back on the phone a few times was Dr. Lester Spence from Johns Hopkins University. Well, we'll let them push back together here in the next hour, so stay with us.